The summer of 2014 would have been a memorable one for the Brown family, even without the tragic loss of their son. On June 9th, they lost their house to a fire, and then on July 16th, Michael Brown Sr. married the love of his life, Calvina. Standing at his side was his son, Mike Brown Jr., also known as Mike, in the role of best man. But these events were eclipsed by a call Michael Sr. received around lunchtime on Saturday, August 9th, informing him that Mike was lying dead in the street on Canfield Drive. Journalist John Richardson spent time with the family during their first Thanksgiving without Mike, and he's written an intimate portrayal of them for the January-February edition of Esquire called "I Should Have Been There to Protect Him," the intimate story of Michael Brown Sr. and the agony of the black father in America. I'm very pleased that it brings John Richardson back to our show and Michael Brown Sr. for the first time. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Michael, first of all, I want to extend my condolences to you for your loss.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
John, the Thanksgiving you write about came just 3 days after the grand jury decided not to bring charges against Darren Wilson. There's been much speculation about the prosecutor's connections to law enforcement and his approach to this case that's been criticized. What, in your view, are some of the questionable tactics and practices that he employed?
You're asking me?
Yeah.
Well, I'm not really adding anything to what's been said, but the giving all the evidence to the jurors and instructing them on the law that was overturned 20 years ago, and then correcting it at the very last minute after they'd evaluated all the evidence in the light of that. The case itself was handled very bizarrely. I've talked to prosecutors who say they've never seen any case like that.
On the other hand, hasn't it been pointed out that prosecutors are reluctant to seek indictments of police officers in general in cases like these, as we saw right here in Staten Island?
I think that's true.
You're right. The Ferguson authorities bungled a crime scene investigation by failing to measure the distance between shooter and victim, failing to record the first interview with the officer, failing to take his gun away at the scene, failing to prevent him from washing his hands, and the medical examiner couldn't be bothered to replace his dead camera battery. Does a series of errors like this happen very often in a situation like this?
Well, I'm not an expert on police procedures. My feeling at first was, boy, they really sort of messed this up. And gradually, I sort of began to wonder whether the worst conspiracy theories were true and whether they did it on purpose.
Michael, Mike was left lying in Canfield Drive for more than 4 hours. Was he still lying in the street when you arrived?
Yes, he was still laying in the street when I arrived.
How long did you have to wait for them to let you identify the body?
I never did.
You didn't? Didn't you say, this may be my son who's out there?
When I got there, he was covered up. A few residents said that that's who it was. I still was, couldn't believe that was him up under that towel. That was up under that sheet that he was laying up under. But, yeah, the whole time he was out there, they never gave us a chance to identify him.
And how were you treated during the time that you were waiting?
We was treated like we had no relationship or no relationship with the person that was out there that he was claiming to be Michael Brown Jr.
The police have said that your son was killed 35 feet away from Darren Wilson's SUV, but hasn't it been reported that it might have actually been 148 feet?
Yeah, I can't speak too much on that.
John, have you looked into that?
I've heard different things and seen different accounts and analyses of it. I'm not really clear how far he was, and there's also an issue of how far he may have run and may have come back. And whether he was pursued, there's a lot of questions there.
And whether the bullets were first shot into his back rather than with him coming toward the officer. Darren Wilson said that he felt like a 5-year-old fighting Hulk Hogan. Michael, how big was your son?
My son and Darren Wilson was the same height, just different weight.
But they've made your son taller, haven't they?
Well, I'm sorry. He was a 6'2". He was 6'4", 270, 270 pounds. So.
And you say most of it was just flab.
Yeah.
Now, John, Darren Wilson, how many hours of testimony did he give at the grand jury hearings?
I think he spoke for 4 hours.
Now, he was never cross-examined because he was testifying before a grand jury. But isn't the prosecutor expected to ask hard questions?
I'm not sure what the prosecutor is expected to do and what not expected to do. He's supposed to, in good faith, seek a prosecution. In this case, he wasn't seeking a prosecution. He was I'm not sure whether he was seeking it to be thrown out, but he wasn't seeking a prosecution. He wasn't arguing for a prosecution, so he apparently did not cross-examine.
The St. Louis Dispatch reported today that, I'm quoting, a member of the grand jury is suing St. Louis County Prosecutor Robert McCulloch for the right to speak publicly about the proceedings. According to the lawsuit, this juror believes the legal guidelines presented to jurors in applying facts to the case were muddled and untimely compared to other cases.
I'm really interested to hear what this juror had to say. He was also complaining that there was a presumption that they were unanimous in their decision, whereas I talked to a top defense attorney who told me that only four jurors could have nullified that prosecution. If only four people had voted not to bring a prosecution, that would preclude a prosecution.
I'm talking with John Richardson, who has written an article called I Should Have Been There to Protect Him, The Intimate Story of Michael Brown Sr. and the Agony of the Black Father in America. It's in the current issue of Esquire magazine. And also with us is Michael Brown Sr., who said that. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Was that one of the first thoughts you had? I should have been there to protect him, Michael?
Yes.
John, yes, go ahead.
You know, that's every client. Well, you know, that could be a nightmare, you know. You always want to be there to protect your child, you know. Yes, that was the first thing that came across my mind.
John describes those moments for you as a haze of grief and disbelief. When did you realize for sure that it was Mike out there under that sheet with all that blood?
Well, after a while, he wasn't out there with the crowd. You know, I didn't receive a phone call from him. You know, it kind of started becoming a reality when I was kind of in a cloud, you know. Just actually couldn't believe that this was actually happening, you know, to us right now at this point. But, yeah, it just, after they removed him, the medical examiners tried to give us a number or whatever, and they let us know that that was actually him. But to identify him, to go walk up and say, that's my son, they didn't give us that choice.
Now, why was he allowed, or why was he kept lying there in the street for 4 hours? Is that
well,
typical?
They claimed that they couldn't hold down the crowd. They said the crowd was in an uproar. They felt like they couldn't do their job. So they moved the tape back, had us scoop back a little more away from the scene so they could kind of do their job. But they felt that the crowd was overpowering them doing their job as far as the investigation.
John, the scene you describe is hard to comprehend, with Mike's mother, Leslie McFadden, screaming, the police afraid to move the body, the entire neighborhood being held at bay by police dogs and armed officers. Why do you think it unfolded that way?
Well, part of it was apparently coincidence. They had to wait for the detectives to come, and it took them an hour and a half to get there. They were doing something else. Part of it seems to have been fear of the crowd, although they had, after a while, more than 100 police officers there. It seems a little bizarre, and certainly there's at the Boston bombing, you know, they have lots of crowd scenes, and it's surprising they weren't more able to handle it. But ultimately, I have to say, I haven't talked to these officers, and I don't like to leap to judgment, and there maybe is a good story, but I have to think that if it was a prominent person in society, a celebrity or a politician, that body would not have laid on the ground for 4 hours. It's shocking.
Michael, an editorial in today's New York Times points out that although Ferguson's population is two-thirds African-American, its mayor, city manager, 5 of its 6 city council members are white, and so are its police chief and all but 3 members of its 53-member police force, and that although 3/4 of the district's 12,000 students are black, the 7-member school board includes only 1 African-American. Is this something that's been talked about in the community? How did this happen?
Well, actually, this is the whole thing. I just want to clear this part up, that my son was over there visiting his grandmother. We were announced in that community. We both was born and raised in Pine Line, Missouri. I really wasn't up on too much of what was going on in Ferguson until this actually happened to my son. It's a lot of things that needs to be taken care of or looked at, you know, to get an understanding on why these things, or why haven't no changes been done in certain communities. But I really don't have no information over in that area, so.
Well, John, you write that St. Louis is one of the most segregated cities in America, much of it the result of city policies like its 1916 segregation ordinance, the first such referendum in the nation, and then in 1917, a white riot killed more than 48 people, including a baby thrown into a fire. In 1949, when black kids were first allowed into public swimming pools, whites rioted again. And these little Missouri towns are notorious for financing the city governments with the traffic stops of poor black people. Last year, Ferguson issued 33,000 minor crime arrest warrants for a population of 21,000, mostly for traffic violations. Why do you think Ferguson sounds so much more like something that a town in Mississippi or Louisiana or Georgia?
Well, it surprised me. I think that from what I've learned from reading about Missouri history is that they sort of didn't have the truth and reconciliation that a lot of the South had because they were not considered part of the South, so they sort of evaded that.
When Jackie Robinson integrated baseball, I remember that the team that he most didn't want to face was the St. Louis Cardinals because of the fans and the players.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It seems to be a historical thing. And in this regard, I'd like to say something of sympathy for the police officers, just because as people are making this about between minorities versus police officers, but police officers are also part of this much larger system that involves the prison system, the government, the school system, and they're responsible for a little piece, but they're not responsible for all of it. In a country where we have the kind of prison disparities we have, the police are in between all of that.
But Charles Blow points out in today's Times that whites and blacks are treated differently in many cases. Julia Shields, who was a 45-year-old white woman who went on a shooting spree in Chattanooga, Tennessee, while she was wearing body armor. The police took her in peacefully without incident or injury.
Right, without doubt. And, you know, I've experienced this in my own family. I've been talking to my wife. One of our children got a ticket for serving alcohol to underage people when she was 17. But she got a ticket, and she did community service, and she never got into trouble again. She didn't get taken to jail and arrested and put in prison for a few weeks or any of that.
Michael, in the article, you talk about having had the talk with Mike, about how to behave when confronted with police. What did you tell him?
Well, he just asked why do Well, we treat certain ways when we're pulled up or pulled over by the police. And I would just explain to them, you know, just do what you're asked to do. You know, it's not that hard, you know. Get, you know, and if you feel like you're being untreated, get the guy's badge number, and I'll take care of that, you know, because you as a minor, they shouldn't even be talking to a minor anyway. They should be trying to contact their parents. So, but if it's just a small routine, you know, because my son did look older from the back, you know, from the backside. So he looked at maybe probably in his 20s when he was only, you know, in his 16, 17, 18 years when he had to, you know, interact with a police officer.
Did you go through, have similar experiences when you were a kid?
Yes.
And what kinds of experiences were they?
Well, you know, I used to wear long hair, either dreads or braided. So, you know, that was from behind, as I spoke about my son. You're implicated to be something that you aren't until they that's how you're treated down here in St. Louis, you know. They just pull you over and want to just get information from you, I guess, you know, put you in some type of category if you're a good guy or a bad guy or we're watching you type of guy, you know. So it's just a shame. It's just a shame.
Every single black person I spoke to in St. Louis had been stopped by police officers, including ministers, corporate executives, and stopped often enough to budget time into their schedules.
And it's been pointed out that those traffic violations pay for much of the city's budget.
Indeed.
A Washington Post ABC News poll reports that 63% of all whites believe that police in this country treat whites and blacks equally, while 77% of all blacks think they don't. This sounds like a huge gap in our thinking. Are you at all surprised, Michael?
Can you say that one more time? I'm sorry, I kind of went in and out.
A great majority of whites think that the police in this country treat everybody equally. 77% of all blacks think that they don't.
Mm-hmm. To be honest, you know, all police officers are not bad. You know, I know a few that's white, you know, of color, you know. It's just, I don't know how to explain it or say that. It's just the choices that they have to make when they're interacting with colored people, you know. They have to think instead of not assume that something is going to happen in the end for them to use full force on an African-American.
My guests are Michael Brown Sr., who was 19 when he fathered Mike. John Richardson is here. He's written for New York Magazine, Esquire, numerous other magazines. His article, I Should Have Been There to Protect Him, The Intimate Story of Michael Brown Sr. and the Agony of the Black Father in America, is in the current issue of Esquire magazine. We will continue a conversation. And, Michael, a number of listeners have written in with questions. Is it okay if I ask you some of them?
A few of them are fine. I can't really talk about the case. I just want to say that now before I get any questions that has anything to do with this case.
Okay. Well, we'll do that after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we are back with John Richardson and Michael Brown Sr. We're talking about an article, I Should Have Been There to Protect Him, The Intimate Story of Michael Brown Sr. and the Agony of the Black Father in America, which is in the current issue of Esquire magazine. We have a link to it on our show page at WNYC.org. Much was made of the fact that there was, it looked like Mike had been stealing some cigarillos earlier in the day. John, what do we know about that?
Well, it appears that there's still some dispute about whether he paid for some of them and took others. But I think the real shocking thing that changed the discussion was when he shoved a clerk who was trying to stop him from leaving. Again, we don't know exactly what happened, whether this person had history with him or whether he was in the wrong or anything like that. We just don't know. But when he shoved the clerk, the narrative of Mike Brown was a thug, and therefore it's okay to kill him, sort of entered the public discourse. And I mean, first off, the idea that a person is just one thing, that he's a thug, and so, okay, forget everything else. Forget that he took care of his mother-in-law when she got out of the hospital tenderly, but just label him that and forget about him is destructive to all that's human. So I don't like that. But also, in the public discourse, people were pushing it on Fox News, for example, as a way of dismissing the whole thing. Okay, we don't have to think about that.
We ask listeners to share the questions with us on our show page at WMIC.org. And here are some of them. Jeff from Brooklyn wanted to ask you, Michael, if you struggle with the knowledge that unarmed white men are not killed at the same rate as black unarmed men by enforcement officers. So he writes, so many of us feel at least a portion of the pain you must feel and keep you, your family, and families like yours in prayer. Have you been looking at the statistics at all about the difference between the way, we've had a couple of other cases just recently. We had not just your son, but we had Eric Garner, who was unarmed, who was killed. Tamir Rice, a 12-year-old with a toy gun. John Crawford holding but not shooting an air rifle that he pulled off a shelf at Walmart. Antonio Martin had a gun but didn't fire. Jerome C. Reed had a handgun in his car. They were all killed by police, whereas any number of other cases, I mentioned the case of Julia Shields, they were treated differently.
Well, it's a real touchy horror situation to really talk about. I feel like it doesn't matter what color you are or race. I think it's just a movement that are happening when they're in the eyes of a police officer. I think if a few people knew the procedures to do is just to listen and obey what's going on, I think it would be a better outcome in a lot of situations.
Sherry from Washington Heights is curious about how all the public protests, media coverage, and news of other deaths involving black men and women, and now even police, has affected your family's private grief and healing process.
Well, you know, we're not just going to heal overnight with this. I'm choked up with words.
It doesn't really matter. You'd be grieving whether there'd been an outcry or none at all.
Let's take
a call from Stuart from Jersey City. Hi, you're on the air.
Thank you for the honor of this call, Michael. In 1965, Watts went up in flames, and I was a young kid. And I thought, well, that's that community's problem. In 1968, I was in the Marine Corps when the riots occurred in every big city in the nation. And being in the Marine Corps, we were tentatively given the task to go in and suppress riots, which would have put us in a constitutional crisis. Mm-hmm. And luckily, we didn't have to do that. Later on, in the Rodney King riots, it was like, well, here we go again. But this time around, Michael, people who are not of color, people who are not of minorities, have taken to the streets. And it's very personal now to us. What has changed here?
Why do you think that this has had a different, that not just the African-American community, but a lot of different people have been moved by what happened to Mike Mike?
Because, you know, to be honest with me, with you, it's every kid, every person, every human being is a Mike Brown. You know, this is just not started because this happened to my son, you know. This just woke up the whole nation. So, you know, it's white families that they it really doesn't get talked about as much as black, but yeah, it's white families that they lost their child from a police officer too, or been jumped on or mistreated, you know. So this is what makes it so much of a touchy situation, because it affects everyone, you know. Someone has been affected by this in every family. In every family. Either is murdered or a victim of, they've been abused by the law enforcement.
Thank you for calling us. Your wife, Calvina, told one of my producers that Mike told his siblings that summer that he was going to become famous as a rapper, more famous than Biggie Smalls or Tupac Shakur, and he promised to take care of everyone. There are two sides to this question. One is, it was brought up that he was a rapper, and that was another reason to see him as a thug. But Cal says that she believes he's become famous and will help people because of his wrongful death. Does the symbol that he has become help at all?
Yes, you know, this is the thing that bothers me, that they tried to crucify his character. And the things and positive things that's coming out of this kind of rebuilds his character, you understand? Mm-hmm. Because what you all have seen on TV, all of it's not true, and everything that you've heard is not true. So that's why we have to be the voice to carry out, you know, the truth in this. Because, you know, when you don't get the right information, of course others would think that he was a thug or he lived this life like this picture that they're trying to paint. So, yeah, it's going to be a lot of good coming out of this, because the truth will hit the surface.
John,
go
ahead. I'm sorry.
For the ones that just don't understand the situation, because, you know, you see things and how it's worded in papers or said on TV. The first thought is, another black guy being killed and he disrespected the police. And, you know, they close the book, or they close the paper, or they change the channel. You know, when you get the first impression of a situation, that's what people goes off of. So they think the negative, you know. So this is the reason why we're speaking up and giving the right proper information off the truth, you know. And as far as him being a rapper and all that, yeah, that was something he was trying out. But I told him personally, I say, hey, just keep that as a hobby. I need you to go to school. And that's what his focus was on, going to college. So, yeah.
I think, you know, one thing that's most people don't seem to get is that it's not as simple as being respectful to police officers. Eric Garner, before he was attacked by the police, said, "This ends here." He'd been stopped 27 times, arrested 27 times for selling loose cigarettes. That, I don't think people who've never been arrested realize how much that messes up your day and the days afterwards and costs you a lot of money. To be arrested that often for such a petty crime is astonishing. And Mike Brown Jr., also Mike was spoken to by police officers and had this experience as well. So, you know, it's all very well and good to say be polite. That's certainly what I would tell my son. But it's if you're being pushed and hassled and imprisoned at astronomical rates, then it might not be so easy to be polite.
Michael, you say in the article that you've been asked if you've forgiven Darren Wilson, and you know people want you to say yes, but you haven't.
Yeah. I haven't really sat down and contemplated that thought yet. I no comment with that one.
You're described in the article as a very private man. Why did you decide to open up to John?
Well, to be honest, like I say, the my son is not here. I am the voice for him now. So, you know, like I told him, me and my son, we were very private people. We didn't have people all in our business. And, you know, we just mind our own, you know. And now this thing blew up, and a closed mouth don't give out the truth. So I have to open up and express and let the world know that, yeah, he was an average 18-year-old. I'm not going to say he was an angel. But did he deserve to get gunned down like he did?
John,
what's
your take on the response of some members of the NYPD to Mayor de Blasio's statements in relation to these cases?
Well, again, I haven't reported this out, and I don't know those police officers. It just seems to me like, again, it's not them that's putting keeping all these African Americans incarcerated in this country. They're just the tool for it. So, but it seems surprising to me that they don't understand more what it's like to be an 18-year-old black kid who's, like, stopped every day when he leaves his house and thrown into Rikers Island every time he drinks a beer on the stoop. I mean, to me, de Blasio saying, I tell my son to be careful and all that was human, reaching out to a large part of the city. I know they have contract negotiations and all that.
Former Mayor Giuliani blamed Barack Obama and Eric Holder.
Well, this is absurd. That's like saying anybody who ever says anything is responsible for anything that ever happens, which is, against America and free speech.
Mike, just one more thing. Jamie Warren from the Lower East Side wrote in to say, my question for Mr. Brown is, what would you like us to remember about your son?
Well, I would like to, for everyone to remember, is that just the truth, you know, that he was an average 18-year-old, you know, that there's just like every other 18, well, I can't say every other 18-year-old, but just a teenager trying to find himself. And found where he wanted to be in life and was on his way going to college. And what I would like for everyone to know is that he was a good guy. And I'm not going to stop pushing this until we see justice. So as far as him, his name will live forever, you know. And the positive things that, like I said, he wanted to do before he passed is going to be done every year at the same time.
We have a link to I Should Have Been There to Protect Him, the intimate story of Michael Brown Sr. and the agony of the black father in America. It's in Esquire. My great thanks to John Richardson and Michael Brown Sr.
Thank you.